This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of John Quirk, who spent many years working with American intelligence. He's retired now. He travels throughout the world. He teaches at a school in Paris and I believe also in London. He does it over in the Middle East a number of times recently, and he's going to be going back, my understanding is, but fortunately we're going to have him with us this evening talking about what's really going on in the Middle East, what's going on in the Near East, what's going on in Venezuela, because all of these things are going to have a profound impact on the lives of everybody listening to the program this evening. John, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Stan. It's nice to talk to you again.
Well, why don't you sort of bring us up to date on what's going on? Certainly, a few months ago, there was a lot of talk about a war with Iran, and now, of course, that seems to be put on the back burner. But is it really on the back burner, or is
well,
there going to be
point
some...
Well, bring up. I would say, you know, there was, in 2007, there was quite a momentum and a catalyst to move towards a war with Iran regarding their nuclear ambitions. And then the CIA came out with a report almost sandbagging President Bush and contradicting probably 2 to 3 years of intelligence of exactly where Iran was as far as both a peaceful nuclear development and military development. Now, over the last few weeks, and especially this week, there's been two very interesting things happened. Defense Secretary Gates said, and I quote, he believes that Iran is hell-bent on acquiring nuclear weapons. But then again, he warned that the consequences of going to war with Iran would certainly affect our economy. Our military really is not ready for it. This is his opinion. And that if we do go to war with Iran, we still have the problem in Iraq. Shouldn't we get the Iraq situation straightened out better? And then on the other side of it, there are lobbyists, both from the American Jewish community as well as the Saudi community, and that are lobbying President Bush to take action. The words, besides the words of lobbying, the Israelis are preparing for heavy casualties. They expect to be a target of the Iranians following a U.S. strike. So they're preparing food and water and all types of chemical suits and so on and so forth. And then the other thing that's interesting, it's not just the Israelis alone, but the Saudis have been lobbying. And recently the Saudis have been taking very important steps to prepare any counter for radioactive hazards that could happen if the United States attacks Iran nuclear facilities. Now, what you have, where you didn't have this before, you have people like Condoleezza Rice and Secretary Gates urging caution and trying to say we should delay it, even though the military option is against Iran. And then you've got, no surprise, Mr. Cheney, Bush, some of the neocons saying that, look it, we must do something before the Iranians have this stockpiling of fissionable material. So that's basically where we are. I'm going to stick my neck out, and I'd say that I think before President Bush leaves office, we will probably take military action against Iran.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess John Quirk. Go right ahead, John.
Well, you know, there's a lot of other indicators. The Iranians have built up Hezbollah in Lebanon. They haven't succeeded in overthrowing the Lebanese government, but they're trying hard. They're trying to upset the peace process that has gone, moot almost. The Israelis are not succeeding in really doing much about Hamas. They haven't done anything about Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is completely built up with weapons and rockets that could now hit almost any part of Israel. You remember last time that Israel invaded Lebanon to take out Hezbollah, they were only hitting certain parts of Israel. Now, my sources say that Hezbollah has enough rockets and power to hit anywhere in Israel. So the Israelis are worried about Hezbollah. They're worried about the West Bank. They're worried about a complete breakdown in any kind of negotiations with the Palestinians. And it's a very bad situation. On the American side, we're really caught in several problems if we attack Iran. One is our economy, the money that we're spending. I think it's $12 to $20 million a minute in Iraq. The deficit keeps bloating. You know, the housing market is bad. We have a lot of layoffs in the banks. Yet certain parts of our economy are still doing very well. But the drain on military resources, where we've had large numbers of soldiers on their second, third, and even fourth tour of duty, makes it very, very difficult. So I don't think there's going to be any drawdown of U.S. forces in Iraq. And, at least John McCain is very honest. He's saying we're probably never going to leave Iraq. So all of this, the crisis is actually building. The economic crisis in the United States is building. The military crisis in Iraq is, we still haven't, solved all the problems there. And, of course, the acceleration of the Iranians to be a nuclear power, if not a nuclear weapon state, certainly a nuclear energy state, is causing lots of problems and divisions in our policymaking groups in Washington.
All right, certainly. I share your concern, and so we're going to be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John was simply talking about, of course, the fact that things are not going well in Iraq, that there's lots of things that are going to have to be taken care of over there, and of course, that he had noted that John McCain had said we may have to stay there 100 years. In other words, we're not going to pull out of Iraq, no matter what we're being told. And then, of course, the situation in Israel really is, of course, very, very acute, because now Hezbollah has missiles that can hit almost any part of Israel at any time. And, of course, Hezbollah is dedicated to the destruction of Israel, and the question is not if but when those missiles are going to be flying. And then, of course, Iran certainly seems to be intent upon becoming a nuclear state, whether it be nuclear power or nuclear weapons. But, John, why should we be concerned about Iran having nuclear power? Certainly, we can't object to them having nuclear power. Certainly, we have nuclear power. There's a lot of difference between nuclear power and nuclear weapons, isn't there?
Yes, and the official policy now of the United States is that they are not against Iran having peaceful uses of nuclear power. I mean, this is a fact. The United States is not opposed to that. However, there's the whole area of mistrust, very little diplomacy, very little negotiation, and I would say very poor intelligence on exactly where Iran is on the map. Now, former Ambassador Dennis Ross, who helped, architect the former Mideast peace process, said by 2009, Iran will be a nuclear power, if not a nuclear weapon state. The Israelis say by 2009, which is just around the corner, they will have enough fissionable material to make 3 to 10 bombs. They already have a deployment system. So, here's the problem. The problem is the failure of diplomacy. The problem is the unbelievably high price of oil, even though we're getting more oil from Libya. We're getting oil now from Iraq. We're getting oil, of course, from Saudi Arabia. We're still getting oil from Chavez's Venezuela, but oil is continuing to go up. So the conundrum here is you've got one side of the Bush administration. Dick Cheney's recent trip to the Middle East is seen as a preparation for the U.S. attack. There are other clear signs today that the Bush administration is not going to wait that long for military action. He's going to take military action before he leaves office. And there's also the political consequences here that in such a situation, if we did take military action against Iran, even though many, many Americans are against us being in Iraq, Americans would pull together, there'd be a certain amount of fear there, and that would probably propel McCain to the White House. So there's political concerns, there's economic concerns, there's moral concerns. The whole idea, the Iranian president and even the former Iranian president, Khatami, has said that it's only going to take one bomb to wipe out Israel. They keep saying this. They keep putting this out, this rhetoric out. So it's very interesting. If you see and read what Mr. Gates is saying, he's very worried about the military. He believes that the military is not organized and equipped for a future war, okay, against Iran. He criticized the Air Force the other day. He hasn't criticized the Navy, but he's very, very concerned about that we will not have the ability or probably the ordinance in that area to take out all the nuclear sites. So I think the United States had a plan at one time to look for almost a Gulf of Tonkin or a provocative act. And the Iranians didn't buy into that, and they backed off. If you look at what General Petraeus was saying, he laid a lot of the trouble in Iraq to Iran, okay? But he didn't really come out and aggressively say they're all of the problem in Iraq. They're not supporting all of the counterinsurgency, but some of it, and they're giving some aid. So, you know, you have all these divergent forces going on, and I think the final decision, I think the decision has already been made by both the neocons, I would say the Cheney group, the Bush group, not the Condoleezza Rice group or not the Defense Secretary Robert Gates group, but I think that the overall policy making is going to be that we're going to attack Iran.
But of course, certainly as we look at see what's happening to our economy, we see the skyrocketing price of oil, and certainly if we...
Dan, I'm losing you a little bit here.
Let's see. Can you hear me at all there? Is that coming?
Yeah, from? It's better.
All right, fine. Certainly, what's happening as far as the price of oil is concerned here in the United States, this is disconcerting, but even more so than that, if we were to go to war with Iran, that could be very well drive the price of oil up even further, couldn't it?
Yes, I think it would. Any kind of war, with Iran now would affect the European economy. It would certainly affect our economy. It would affect the bright spots in our economy, the stock market. It would be a catalyst for more problems in the mortgage, housing, credit market. It would raise the price of oil, and people are really suffering now with the high gasoline prices. And it's starting to cause a domino ripple effect because people are now talking about not taking vacations in the summer. That affects hotels and tourism. Some of the airlines are even thinking of doubling the price of airfares over to Europe, which will affect the European economy as well as the airlines, which are in trouble now. So all of these things have an effect. A lot of the advisors in the Bush administration think that this will be a temporary effect, and that in the long run, such an attack on Iran will help Israel, will help Saudi Arabia, it might reverse the unbelievably downward trend of the dollar, which doesn't seem to be really declining at all now. So, again, you've got, it's no longer military. There's political considerations with the election, and there's economic considerations. And then you've got, you know, I'd like to talk about our soft underbelly, and that's Venezuela.
All right, fine, because I know you're very, very close to the situation in Venezuela. We sort of ignore that, but of course Chavez is down there as a man who seems to hate the United States. In fact, has based his reputation on hatred of the United States and has made alliances, of course, with Iran and with the Chinese communists and all of those other countries, of course, which would love to see our nation destroyed. So let's talk a little bit about what's going down there in Venezuela. As Chavez seems to be intent upon nationalizing many of the other industries besides oil.
Yes, well, let's talk about what he's spending in military. He spent about $3 billion on Russian arms. He's going to Moscow next month in May, and he's purchasing more arms. And it's interesting, he's purchasing three Russian Kilo-class submarines. These are diesel-electric submarines that have the same capability of putting these Russian missiles and torpedoes on that could sink our carriers. They're very old. Well, they're old technology compared to our technology, but our sonar and our radar equipment finds it very difficult to find these old submarines. I'm not a sonar expert, but my friends in the Navy say these things are very difficult to detect because our equipment is so sophisticated. So Chavez is buying that. He's buying more military attack helicopters. He's buying hundreds of thousands of these guerrilla packs. They're designed that if he and his chavistas have to go up into the mountains like Castro did and like they had in guerrillas in Venezuela in the 70s, that they would be equipped. They have cell phones in these packs and food and water processing and medical equipment and drugs and things like that. And then, of course, we have quite a bit of evidence now with the recent Colombian attack on FARC. They found computers that prove that Venezuela has given about $300 million to FARC and weapons. This Sunday, I'll be meeting the former ambassador to Colombia. He's a good friend, Alfonso Lopez. His father and brother were presidents of Venezuela, of Colombia. I'm sorry, he's very close to President Uribe in Colombia. And they are in a quandary what to do about Chavez. Chavez is also planning to sign a mutual non-aggression type pact with Nicaragua, Cuba, Ecuador, and Bolivia. Ecuador last week basically told the United States that our 4,000 troops would have to leave Ecuador. So Chavez is really winning. He's succeeding in a lot of the things that he's doing, as well as continuing dismantling democracy. He signed recent agreements with Iran, and one of the Russian republics, Belarus, has signed a anti-missile defense plan with him. So there's going to be an anti-missile defense series of anti-American missiles based in Venezuela.
And I think so, that's really such a key issue that we are really facing, a neighbor to the south where Iran or communist China or any of the other Soviet bloc nations could bring their missiles. It'd be very easy, Christian, to target the southern part of the United States with that. And most Americans really don't think it could ever happen here. Are you concerned about the possibility of missiles being stationed there in Venezuela?
Yes, I'm very concerned because there's been rumors that the Chinese are building a satellite launch place in Sucre State. The Chinese have just finished not only a big railway line, they've added a bigger link for port facilities to ship Venezuelan oil through the Panama Canal, which the Chinese control on both sides.
Well, that's all. We're going to be right back in just a moment here. Well, our guest this evening is John Quirk, and we're talking about what's going on in Venezuela, the fact that the Chinese, through Hutchinson and Whampoa, could really control both sides of the Suez Canal, that they have multiple bases throughout the Caribbean, that the Chinese communists are certainly going in and building infrastructure all throughout the Caribbean and certainly in Venezuela and elsewhere to get, of course, support. They're doing exactly the same thing in Africa, and they're winning the people over to their point of view. They even have their troops now in Zimbabwe, where, of course, they're keeping Robert Mugabe in power. And, of course, what people have forgotten is that the American State Department put Mugabe in power in Rhodesia back in 1980, and now the Chinese communists are keeping him in power. We certainly have strange bedfellows. And, you know, one of the things that really concerns me, John, is why are we going over to the Olympics? I would think we'd embargo the Olympics because of, you know, the brutal anti-humanitarian policies of communist China, and communist China is challenging us all throughout the world today.
Well, remember when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, we boycotted the Russian Olympics in 1980. I think it's different. Our policies towards China are really schizophrenic. They're double standard. On the one hand, we don't want them to build up a blue water navy and kick us out of the Pacific, which is their ultimate goal, and we don't want them to throw more GNP into building more ships and military. And on the other hand, we just can't get away from the massive amounts of trade we do. We ignore the fact that they're continuing to bail us out of debt, and they really are in the process of owning us financially. And at the same time, you know, the Bush family has had tremendous investments in China. A lot of the coast is leased to Prescott Bush and his family. That's George Sr.'s brother. So they have a lot of interest. They have a good, you know, part of it is good relations with China, which are important. But I think that we give in to the Chinese. I think we buckle down. I think that we talk about human rights in Tibet. But we don't want to lose that trade. The other thing is that American corporations and companies have signed thousands of strategic agreements with Chinese companies. And it's always a one-way street. We give up our intellectual property and our technology hoping to get into that massive market, and I don't see it happening. And we better wake up to what China's all about. China wants to control the shipping lanes. They want to dominate the world. Forget communism. They just want to dominate the world economically. And they're signing agreements with all of our CARICOM nations. These are countries in the Caribbean, the Bahamas, Jamaica, Grenada, Guyana, and Barbados. They've signed port facility agreements. And if you look on an arc, if you had a map, there'd be an arc that goes from Fort Lauderdale to the Bahamas all the way to the eastern end and the western end of the Caribbean, linking up Venezuela through the Gulf right to Panama, where they control both ends of the Panama Canal Zone. So they have spent billions of dollars, and they're continuing. They want it for, of course, trade, but they also want it for military. They want to use it as a foil against our Taiwanese policy. They want to use it against various things. And they're continuing to develop long-range ballistic missiles.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John was just talking about the fact that the Chinese communists want to really dominate the Pacific. They want to dominate the Caribbean. And, of course, they want to cut off America's access to markets throughout the world. Certainly, there seems to be almost a schizophrenic response to China today. John sees this very obviously as, of course, on one hand, why we abhor the treatment of the people in Tibet, the Chinese human rights violations. On the other hand, the Bush family is very heavily invested along the coast, and much of the coastal area of China is controlled by Prescott Bush, the George Herbert Walker Bush's brother. And certainly the Chinese communists are for signing all sorts of agreements with American corporations. We're encouraging our corporations to go over there. Our banks, of course, are merging with their banks. We are financing through various agencies all sorts of the developments in communist China, guaranteeing loans so that Westinghouse can build a couple of nuclear power plants over there. Why are we doing this? It's almost, on one hand, why we see what a terrible and ruthless regime this is. On the other hand, we're doing everything we can to help them and not objecting at all as they are progressively encircling us through all of their agreements with the Caribbean nations and then with Venezuela and then controlling our canal, the Panama Canal. Why are we doing these things, John? It doesn't make
any
sense.
Well, I think a lot of it is for money, greed. You know, Americans are capitalists, and they see the immediate results of quick dollars. But going back to what the Chinese are doing in Venezuela of surveying for a satellite base and building a railroad, if that had happened during the Kennedy years, we would have had the CIA overthrowing the Venezuelan government or trying to, or we would have used kind of the military in the Cuban Missile Crisis setting. But what amazes me, I've supported the Bush administration in what we're doing in Iraq, even though some of the intelligence was cooked for policymakers. And I support what we're doing in Iran, and I support what we're doing in Afghanistan, and I believe that today the enemy that we face are these violent jihadist networks that want to wipe out Christianity and Judaism. We've got to be fighting those people. And Bush does not get enough credit for the successes we've had. But where I see our policymakers really falling down, and I'm very critical of it, is our attitude towards Latin America. That is our soft underbelly. We can't control our borders with Mexico. There's more and more of the drug cartels killing policemen and politicians in Mexico. You've got Ecuador and Bolivia in Chavez's back pocket. You've got the Cubans, of course, that have benefited tremendously from Venezuelan oil and money. You have other countries possibly tottering to go along with Chavez. And we let Chavez buy billions of dollars of sophisticated weapons, not just, you know, low-level weapons from the Russians, but he's got fighter airplanes and so on. Not that he could defeat us in a war, but I think his long-term plans, he has told his colleagues, we know this from defectors, and we know it from listening from our intelligence agencies, that he wants to be the man to go down in history to destroy America. And everything I see him doing, the dismantling of democracy, helping other countries. He's been more successful than Castro was in the 60s and 70s in exporting Marxism. What Chavez is doing is exporting hatred of America, and we are doing very little or almost nothing to stop him or hinder him. And I'm more afraid of Chavez as a national security threat than I am of Iran, or even the fact that a small group of jihadists could obtain a nuclear weapon. Chavez, if you look at it, he's got money, he's got the will, he's got the support of a lot of the poor people in Venezuela, and he supports FARC. Hezbollah and Hamas have offices in Venezuela, and the media and our policymakers write very, very little about it.
And I certainly agree with you, and I share your concerns. One of the things that really bothers me is that they had elections down there, maybe a few months ago, and I think that, as I remember, Chavez wanted to change the Constitution, and, you know, in an open and free election, he lost that election. So I would think that would have undermined a great deal of his support in the country. What happened? How is he?
Well, it was a tremendous plus for democracy. But what he's done since then is through various small bits of legislation in the Venezuelan Congress, he has positioned himself the next election to win and really be dictator for life. And he's told a lot of people he's just not going to pay attention to the last referendum.
All right, so like Robert Mugabe, we'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest John Quirk, and we're talking about certainly what's going on in Venezuela, and certainly most people don't even think about Venezuela, and yet Venezuela is a fairly substantial source of oil for the United States. If the oil from Venezuela would be cut off, why, it would work a hardship on us. Certainly our major sources of oil are Mexico and Canada. And, of course, then, of course, Venezuela, Nigeria. I think there's one other. And then, of course, the Arab countries. We really don't get that much oil from the Arab countries. It's mainly Europe that's so dependent on Arabian oil. But, of course, we'd certainly hate to lose that 10% that we're getting over there. My understanding, however, is that China's trying to get more and more of the Venezuelan oil. China's making all sorts of arrangements to get the oil out of Canada as well. Certainly, do you think that, that China then could very well undermine our basic economy, which is oil-dependent, by, of course, diverting oil from Venezuela and Canada away from the United States?
Well, I never thought so before, because we had so much oil from Mexico, Canada, and so on, but our country, we are so gluttonous. We are still driving these 8-mile-a-gallon SUVs, and people aren't buying hybrids. Of course, the economy is bad. They don't have the money. I think the United States is just a very wasteful country, and we need more and more oil, and the Saudis are willing to pump it. We've got, we're going to probably score a lot with Iraqi oil. They have billions of dollars of surplus now in their treasury. Eventually, I think we're going to get some of that money. The Chinese and Russians and Americans are fighting over the big oil, billions of barrels in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and so on. But I think what the Chinese will do, they don't have to do a lot to affect our economy. If the Venezuelans cut their 14.5% oil off, in the likely scenarios, if we attack Iran, the Venezuelans would do that. Chavez is already making lots of things to hurt the dollar overseas. If they do that, I think our economy is so fragile, the stock market would drop. Now, you wouldn't say this 20 years ago, but our economy, whether it's employment or the stock market or housing or interest rates, is so fragile that another big oil crisis could really tank our economy and drive us into something worse than a recession. Now, if you look at today, people are still paying the $3.50 a gallon. They're doing that.
Hold that thought, John. We're going to be back in just a moment when we pull our station. Dan, and our guest is John Quirk, and John really has a tremendous grasp of what's going on. Talking about Venezuela, we get about 14.5% of our oil from Venezuela, and my understanding is that Venezuela does have some sort of a non-aggression pact with Iran. If we were to attack Iran, why, suddenly Chavez is threatening to cut off our oil from Venezuela. Now, John is pointing out that we have a very fragile economy. We've never had it in the past, but increasingly we are fragile. We're having to borrow money. We're the greatest debtor nation that the world has ever known, having to borrow $2.5 billion from other countries, simply, or at least borrow $2.5 billion, much of it from other countries, simply to pay our debts every day, to finance the war and all the other incredible programs we have, and the giveaway programs, while we're borrowing money from other countries to maintain our budget to pay off our debts, we're still giving money to other countries in the form of foreign aid. It's almost as if the world has gone mad. But Sidney John points out that if there were a war, it could have a tremendous impact on our society and simply the very structure of our stock market, our financial system, and of course, what would happen if our financial system really began to collapse? You go ahead and pick up the story from there, John.
Well, I think in previous conflicts with Nazi Germany and Japan, it was basically diplomacy and then military action. Nobody really could take on the United States. I mean, we were coming out of the Depression between 39 and the time we went to war in 41 and then through the war to 45, and we just printed more money and our industrial capabilities just dominated the world and we became a superpower. We became even a stronger superpower after the fall of the Soviet Union with treaties, military bases overseas. We have huge bases in Romania and Bulgaria and so on. But I see a conspiracy between our enemies. I think our enemies, and I probably started with Bin Laden, but other people were thinking about it, the Russians, the Chinese, certain Arab states, countries like Venezuela and Cuba, have realized to damage us economically is the best way to undermine us. And they can damage us through the use of oil or the holding back oil, prohibiting us to have certain amounts of oil. They've certainly damaged us, or we've damaged ourselves almost since 9/11 with the dollar going down, the housing market. If you look at the recent bailouts, I don't know where we're getting all the money. We're giving $7 billion to Bear Stearns. We're giving $20 billion to another bank. We're propping up all the major banks in the United States and at the same time dropping the interest rates. And yet, banks are not loaning. You have to have 130% credit to be able to borrow a house. There's more and more foreclosures every day. So, in addition to that, you mentioned foreign aid. We've just signed agreements to give billions more to Turkey to keep them quiet about Kurdistan, I'm sure, and to support us in the war against terrorism. We're giving money to African states. We're giving billions to Egypt to prop them up. We're terrified that the Islamic Brotherhood could take over Egypt and threaten Israel. We're giving billions more to Israel because they've become psychologically weak, and they've also become, I would say, to a certain extent, economically weak in that, you know, they're an island out there. It's a democratic island in a sea of, you know, almost radical Arab states or states that are having problems, and we're giving a lot of money to those Arab states. We're giving money to Jordan. We're giving money to Egypt, to Tunisia, to Morocco. We want to give money to make some agreements with Sudan and Chad. That's not happening yet because of Darfur, but it may happen. So in addition to that, we're expanding tremendous numbers of military facilities in Central Asia, Romania, Bulgaria, Poland. We're giving Eastern Europe tremendous amounts of money, and I don't know how we're going to fund it all. I just don't. I mean, it's like a nonstop. Everybody, we have an open checkbook to everybody.
Well, of course, what you do is you just print more money, and this is exactly what we're doing, printing more money, creating credit. Of course, this is highly inflationary, and it undermines the dollar. And, of course, as Lenin had said, there's no better way to destroy a nation than to debauch its currency, and not one person in a million will understand what they're doing. Today, the Chinese communists have about $1.4 trillion in reserves, and a good part of that, $800 or $900 billion of that, is American dollars. And of course, if those dollars were ever released and flooded to this country, it would put us a rampant inflation that would make the Weimar Republic look like a picnic day. So,
I agree completely. And you know, the old expression "dollar diplomacy" was started in America. We started this in the 1800s, and it continued. That's what the Chinese are doing. They're using dollar diplomacy. They're going in and they're buying the Bahamas. They're buying Jamaicans. They're buying diplomats. They're buying Africans. They're probably spending more money today in Latin America than we did in the 50s through the 80s to get those resources. They want the resources, and they've got the money to buy them. And they do everything to outmaneuver us. In all of the major conferences in Asia, we're never invited. Thailand is invited. Singapore is invited. The other countries are invited. The United States is always marginalized. They don't want us in the Pacific.
And I really think that the average American is living in a fool's paradise when he thinks that everything's going to be all right, or they're going to be able to work things out. You cannot keep borrowing more money, you know, year after year after year, and running up these massive deficits, because sooner or later the rest of the world is going to quit taking dollars, realizing, of course, the value is falling very rapidly. In fact, everybody's concerned about the price of oil going up, but it's not really that the price of oil is going up as much as the fact that the value of the dollar is going down. but they never tell us that. Isn't that interesting? It was just yesterday that they announced that the value of the euro, the European currency, had hit a new high. What does that mean? It means, of course, that the value of the dollar had fallen to a new low, but they can't tell the American people that. We might wake up to the fact that there's no incidents in all history where a nation has had a fiat money system and has survived. And, of course,
I couldn't agree with you more. I was over 60 days, and I'm going back to Europe Monday, and I was 60 days overseas when the dollar started really to go up, and I can tell you, for Americans, it's $7 for a Coca-Cola. It's $8 to take the shuttle bus to London. Hotels are expensive. You can spend $5 for a cup of coffee in Paris, maybe $4 out in Normandy, and where I am. But it's unbelievable. And the Europeans are actually weathering it better because they have all these social networks. You know, people don't have to worry about health care. Most of the people in this country are struggling with health care, either making the premium payments or they don't have health care. So all of these things are coming together. And the thing that really bothers me, where I've had an interesting perspective being overseas 60 days, not one of our three presidential candidates really has a solution, an economic solution. If you look at Obama, he made a statement the other day, well, if Iran is the United States has nuclear weapons, why shouldn't Iran have it? Scares the heck out of me that this man would be president and negotiating with people like Hugo Chavez or the Iranian president. Clinton scares me, even though she has a little bit more experience, because she has always been almost anti-intelligence community, law enforcement, and national security. I mean, she could change. And the problem, I think, with McCain, he doesn't have any solutions for economic problems, and he's on that national security military thing. And if anything, we've got to try to get our military spending in hand. Our military and foreign policy spending is completely out of hand compared to what we call domestic national security spending. In other words, national security isn't just overseas spending on military and aircraft carriers and bases. National security is taking care of our own people here. Scholarships, health care, roads, bridges, infrastructure, and border patrol. And I think we're losing the battle in all of those domestic national security issues.
And I certainly agree with you. Of course, we might disagree on the solution to the health care crisis, but certainly today the United States puts out more money for our military than all of the rest of the countries of the world put together. All of the rest of the countries put together. In fact, we pay for the defense for Japan. So Japan, of course, doesn't have to worry about having an army and a navy. And then, of course, they can subsidize their exports and undercut us in world markets. And we're doing similar foolish things all throughout the world. And it seems that they're intent upon transferring the wealth of the United States to other nations and impoverishing our people. And, of course, if Obama gets in, why, I mean, you think taxes are high now, you just wait till Obama gets through with it. He's already openly talked about the necessity of raising taxes. I think Hillary will raise them as well. Of course, you can't keep, you know, we can't cut taxes and increase spending. And that was George Bush's solution. Cut taxes, increase spending, and, of course, it's all going to come out in the wash. And you can see that now we have, I think, a $9.3 trillion national deficit. And that's just what they admit to. Actually, it's closer to $50 to $60 trillion if you look at it actuarially. Because we've spent all of the Medicare funds. We spent all the Social Security funds. There is no Social Security Trust Fund, or there is no Social Security Medicare Fund. People talk about the Highway Fund, all that's in that, you know, Federal Highway Fund. We spent all that money. We put in IOUs, and what's the IOUs backed on? By a nation that has to borrow $2.5 billion every day just to pay its bills. How are we going to get out of the mess we're in, John?
Well, you know, the amazing thing the other day, you know, it was discovered or revealed that the Iraqi treasury is full of billions of dollars from oil revenue. In the United States, you know, we're going to have one of the biggest embassies in the world, over 2,500 people in the new embassy in Baghdad. the diplomats made an approach, Crocker, in that to release some of that money to pay us back for us maintaining the army. And we're rebuilding schools there, hospitals, we're rebuilding the roads. I mean, every time there's a bomb going off, United States dollars are fixing that and so on. And the Iraqis, basically, the Shias in power, told us to get lost. They're a sovereign nation. I mean, they forget who saved them, who got rid of Saddam Hussein. They're a sovereign nation, and they're going to hold on to that money and use that money to build their own infrastructure. When part of that money, I mean, I'm talking billions of dollars, they're pumping more oil than ever, could be used to pay us back to at least soften the money we give them, even if they don't pay us back, and we let them get away with it. And most of the people in the Baghdad government are in bed with the Iranians anyway, in terms of intelligence or, you know, eventually hoping they're going to have a Shia arc, you know, from Iraq to Iran. This is what the Saudis don't understand about us. They're lobbying President Bush and the administration to attack Iran even more than the Israelis do. You know, people criticize the Israelis and American Jews as having too much influence on our foreign policy. I mean, the Arabs want us to take out the Iranians. So it's like everything is upside down. Now, one positive thing. The Iran today is very vulnerable to economic pressure because Iranian revenue gets about 85% of its total export revenue from oil. And if we squeeze them on oil, we can cause that regime to be unpopular and possibly abandon its nuclear weapons efforts. But as Ambassador Ross said, we're running out of time. That if we don't stop them by next year, they will have enough fissionable material, enough weapons-grade uranium, that we won't be able to stop them. And then there'll be trouble. There'll be trouble between the United States and Europe diplomatically. Israel won't wait around for the United States to do something. Iran could even do a preemptive strike. And you don't know what Venezuela is going to do. So it's going to be, I think, between, I would say, July and the November elections, one of the scariest times in American history. We really have to use good judgment and do the right thing.
And I certainly believe that these are really the times that will try men's souls. I was just thinking as you were talking, you know, we, of course, are spending a great deal of money, but guarding the borders of Iraq so that the terrorists can't get in. But we can't, of course, guard our own borders and keep the terrorists and the illegal immigrants from coming into this country. We are rebuilding the roads over there and the clinics and the hospitals and the schools over in Iraq, but we don't have any money to, you know, here in the United States, to rebuild our infrastructure. And certainly as you look at the infrastructure, many of our bridges are outmoded. They needed to be repaired, and there's a real shortage of funds for doing so much of what needs to be done to look after the United States. And as you say, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, it doesn't make sense, and you don't understand why we don't have better policies on the border. The other thing about these three presidential candidates, as well as the previous presidential candidates, I mean Bush and Kerry and Bush and Gore, nobody even talks about drug enforcement anymore. Not in one debate, not in one town hall meeting, does anybody ever talk about drug enforcement. And we've got more drugs coming in from Mexico. Mexico now is the number one supplier of heroin, cocaine, marijuana, and meth. They've outstripped the Sicilian Mafia, the Colombians, and the people in Burma.
But of course,
of that whole thing is Border Patrol, and we're doing nothing about it.
But, of course, the largest producer of heroin in the world today is Afghanistan, which we control. When we control that country, why can't we do anything about the drugs there? Oh, well, my goodness, it would hurt the poor farmers. I mean, how would they get by if they couldn't actually grow their heroin? I was talking to a former Undersecretary of the Defense today who's written a book, and I asked him that question. He was telling me, well, this would hurt the farmers in Afghanistan if we took away their major a financial crop. Well, if we really have a war on drugs and you control the country, you know, after 6 or 7 years there, you would have come up with an alternative to growing heroin. Seems like we have a war on heroin, and the more war we have on heroin, the more drugs there are out there. So lots of things just don't make sense if you look at them logically. Well, I guess this evening has been John Quirk, and John has a tremendous knowledge of what's going on. When would we be leaving to go back over to the Middle East?
I'm leaving Monday. I'm coming back at the end of May, and then I'm probably going to go back, especially if things heat up, and you'll start to see it every day with Iran. You're going to see a lot of arguments about Iran, and I think President Bush and Cheney and his group probably won over Condoleezza Rice and Gates, and I think everybody's going to be on board.
Here's some of the catalyst.
Hold
the thought there for just a minute. We'll be back in just a moment with John Quirk to wrap up tonight's program. Okay, John, go right ahead.
Well, I think if the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians in the West Bank, forget Gaza, in the West Bank, does not go forward, that will be a push for President Bush to take military action. If the Europeans, and I think France especially, has been very pro-U.S. I mean, I spend a lot of time in France. I teach there at the French Military and Diplomatic Academy. They have really turned around. They're going to be one of our strongest allies. They're against Iran. They're against, you know, jihadists. With Chirac, he was constantly undermining us. England's always our ally. I think they have come over and they support President Bush in doing something about Iran. They will try a little bit more diplomacy. There could be some type of economic blockade, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think that we're going to do limited strikes against Iran, not the full-scale strikes that we had planned against 1,500 targets, but probably strikes against maybe 50 to 100 targets. So it won't get everybody in the world upset. It'll set the Iranians back. It'll please the Israelis and the Saudis. And it'll probably help McCain politically. And I think Bush wants to do that for the Republican Party.
But isn't it a frightening thing that if we establish the justification for preemptive war, that same justification could be used at some time in the future by one of America's enemies against America?
It's a very good point, but Bush has this preemptive policy. I don't know if it's legal internationally. People haven't commented on it, but he started the preemptive strike policy. It's based on this. If a country is engaged in terrorism or there's terrorists in the country, we have the right to do a preemptive strike. I agree with that, okay? But again, if you don't have the intelligence, the United States' reputation is going to go way down, and it's pretty bad now. It's coming up a little bit, but it's way down. And Bush is still extremely unpopular all over the world. So an attack on Iran is not going to make the United States any more popular, but I think it'll probably be the right thing to do.
All right, fine. Well, I guess it's been John Quirk, and of course, we'll look forward to hearing from him. Please give us a call when you get back there at the end of May. Hopefully, we can begin to analyze what's going on, and hope you'll keep us appraised of your travels and what people are saying about the United States and your interpretation as we begin moving towards, I think, a very difficult decision as whether or not to attack Iran. Thanks so much for being with us tonight, John.
You're all the best. God bless America. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Dan here, and of course, a lot of unanswered questions. A lot of things don't make sense if you look at it logically. But of course, if you're looking at it from the point of view that there are powerful spiritual forces out there, everything makes sense. If you haven't heard my talk on the planned police state and gotten the syllabus that goes with that, you really need to. It will give you information you're never going to get elsewhere. That's the planned police state, and we take you into the writings of these occult covert organizations working behind the scenes. You can get their publications, but you'd never even know who they were, how to contact them. They said they want their material distributed, so we're doing it for them without charge. We're distributing their information to the American people, so they will begin to understand what's really going on and why we are helping our communist enemies throughout the world, and of course, our good friends in Great Britain are actually funding, and giving weapons to Iran. Why are we giving sophisticated weapons or selling sophisticated weapons, guided missiles to both Saudi Arabia and Syria that will certainly be used against Israel in the coming times? Unless you understand the prophecies that were laid out in Ezekiel 38 and 39, Revelation 6:8 talks about, and I look and behold a pale horse, and the rider upon him was death. And one of the means they were going to use to destroy the world and kill a quarter of the population was famine. And ladies and gentlemen, famine is rising throughout the world today. There are food riots in Haiti, in Egypt, in Nigeria. A dozen countries have had food riots, and now we suddenly find there's beginning to ration rice here in the United States. Can you imagine that? Oh, shucks. Why is that happening? Well, of course, we did that program the other day with David Sibley talking about the food shortages. Now Costco and other companies are saying, well, of course, you're not going to be able to buy rice here because, of course, we're going to evaluate how you bought in the past. If you've been buying rice in the past, how do they know how we bought in the past? Why, very simply, everything you buy at Costco or everything you buy with a credit card, there's a record of it. They're keeping dossiers on all American citizens. Understand that, and of course, if you have not laid in a supply of emergency food, because I think we're going to be moving into a very difficult situation, give us a call. We'd be glad to send you a catalog, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, and we do hope that you'll begin making plans for the difficult times that lie ahead and caution others to begin making plans, because believe me, there is a plan to create famine in America. We know they're creating new diseases. Where do all these new diseases come from? Where did AIDS come from? They give you lots of explanations, but there were eight different subtypes of that suddenly appeared all across the world at exactly one time. Do you think that happened just by accident? Where did chronic fatigue syndrome come at? Came at the same time that AIDS did. Where did fibromyalgia come from? Came about at the same time. Where did Ebola fever come from? And certainly the new diseases, Morgellons disease, which is plaguing thousands, tens of thousands of people across America. A horrible, horrible disease. Where do they come from? Well, you certainly would want to get the book written by one of the country's leading experts. It's called Project Daylily, written by Dr. Nicholson. Garth Nicholson tells the story of what happened to him when he uncovered the experiments they were doing on prisoners in Huntsville, Texas, and how the disease spread from the prison where they were using it experimentally on the prisoners into the community, into the guards, into their families, and certainly clusters of multiple sclerosis and anterior lateral sclerosis. Why, of course, is MS and ALS increasing so dramatically? Why is the incidence of cancer increasing so radically? It used to be we had, of course, one cancer case in every 33 people. Now it's one in every two. You need to get my talks on Nundare College genocide, on planned population reduction, on population control. You need to get my monograph that, of course, we've written on this subject. And then, of course, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV, war. And then, of course, ladies and gentlemen, pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, formerly the senior editor for the New American Magazine, and now, of course, writing for the his blog on the Welts Report, and, of course, writing books. We carry his book, Liberty and Eclipse. And let me recommend the book to you very strongly. Liberty and Eclipse is a very, very important book because it shows how we are moving rapidly, purposely, intentionally towards a police state. And then, of course, you want to go to William's blog, which he keeps up several times a week, and always fascinating material. And it's very interesting. Of course, I read World Affairs Brief every morning, and it's amazing how often that website picks up the material from William's blog site, and you will want to get it as well. Anyway, of course, you can get to the blog site by going to www.rightsource.com. That's rightsourceonline.com. And right now, though, let's go to William here. William, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, it's great to be with you. Can you hear me all right?
You're doing just fine. Are you in regular hard line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, it's fine. You're coming through well.
I should say I'm having a bit of difficulty hearing you.
All right, fine. Well, I will do. We blew up our board today, so we're using a new experimental board, and let's hope that you can hear me there. Can you hear me fairly well?
A little bit.
All right.
Better.
All right, go right ahead.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk about this evening is the still unfolding story down in Texas, the El Dorado YFZ, Yearning for Zion Ranch of the Fundamental Latter-day Saint Church, in the seizure of these children, 437 children, by the state government. This is a story of epical significance, I think. What we're seeing here is sort of a slow-burning Waco. I honestly believe that if things had turned out the way that the people who orchestrated the Waco raid in 1993 had intended for them to turn out, what you would have had would have been a high-profile PR stunt for the purpose of sanitizing the image of the ATF. They had been run through the publicity ringer a few months earlier involving a number of scandals within the ATF that had a sort of seamy and sordid nature. They were accused of harboring and abetting people within their organizational ranks who were sexually harassing female employees. So what better way to divert the public spotlight and to sanitize the image of the organization than to take down a cult leader in Texas, David Koresh, who was accused of being a polygamist and doing all kinds of other seemly and unseemly things. And so I believe that had things turned out the way the ATF, the people who organized that raid, believed that they would, you would have had the ATF raiders on that morning in February of 1993 dismount from their flatbed trucks and take down the Branch Davidian commune without an exchange of gunfire. These people would have been paraded before the cameras in the now familiar perp walk. Koresh would have been the subject of a months-long high-profile trial. And the children of that Branch Davidian sect, an offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventist movement, would have been farmed out to foster homes throughout the state of Texas and perhaps throughout the region, thereby bringing in subsidies of tens of thousands of dollars a head from the federal government. That's, of course, a big element of what's going on here. They get subsidies in the neighborhood of $30,000 a head for the children they put into the foster care system for adoption to other families.
Well, you hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Grigg. But, of course, the thing about the Davidians is the BATF wanted a spectacular thing. They had their photographers there. Mm-hmm. They were going to show how efficient they and their military approach were. And of course, things got out of hand. They started shooting at the Davidians, and they shot back, and all those little children died.
Yes. Hold on. The code name for that raid was Showtime. Sharon Weaver, the ATF spokeswoman, had been in touch with the local television crews and with network television officials in New York. they had the local Waco, I believe the Waco Herald Journal was the newspaper that had been covering, and with the cooperation of the ATF, preparing the public for this attack on the Branch Davidian sect. They had people riding along from the press on the assumption that they were going to have this glorious hunting expedition and bring in these exotic subjects for the inspection of the media and the delectation of the public. Didn't turn out that way because, first of all, David Koresh knew that they were coming, that he had exposed the ATF undercover agent. He let him go rather than holding him as a hostage. And Koresh tried to prevent the raid. And so you had people from the ATF get off those flatbed trucks and start flinging lead in the direction of this church. They fired the first shots. That's pretty much incontrovertible. And when they fired the first shots, the Davidian shot back, and they kicked the ATF good. They tore them a new one in that firefight. They straight up beat the ATF and allowed them to retrieve their wounded and retreat. And that's not, of course, the way that the script was supposed to play out. The way that the script would have run is that they would have had this very marketable triumph over this so-called cult down in Texas. The kids would have been farmed out and thereby become a revenue source for the state of Texas and the affiliated parasites. It didn't turn out that way, and you ended up with a 51-day siege and the immolation of 75 or 80 people by the FBI at the end of that 51-day siege. But what's going on right now with the El Dorado case is you've got sort of a slow-burning fuse that's going to have a similar result. I believe we're seeing Plan A here. We're seeing many of the same principals who were involved in the 1993 Waco outrage. People like Bruce Perry, the expert psychiatrist and so-called cult authority, who was involved in a similar capacity back in 1993, dealing with the Branch Davidian children who were released during the 51-day standoff. They were taken out of an environment that was very congenial to them, where they were raised in a very healthy lifestyle. They were eating good, unprocessed foods, usually foods that avoided most of the additives and chemicals and, of course, the high sugar content that makes childhood obesity a real problem for most Americans. They were taken out of that environment where they were raised by loving parents and where they were not exposed to the mind-destroying influence of television. The first thing that the Child Protection Services did was start to feed them soda pop and make them watch television. In other words, they were being assimilated into the degenerate consumerist corporatist culture that we live in. This was by way of trying to make them normal, I guess.
Hold that thought there, William. We'll be back in just a moment as we bring other stations back online. But, of course, the great tragedy was I talked to the woman who was ahead of the jury for the trial. She said the wrong people were on trial there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William Grieg is talking about what happened at Waco and the similarity between that and what happened here recently when they raided the polygamous sect. And, of course, the thing is that these were simply a showbiz. These are all to tell us what a pretty a great law enforcement. You know, of course, we have more people in prison in the United States than they have in any other country in the world. We have 2.3 million people in prison in the United States today. China, the ruthless, tyrannical Chinese communists, they only have 1.5 million people in prison with a population of four times what we have in the United States today. But as far as what happened at the Davidian compound back in 1993, what people have forgotten, of course, is that many of those Davidians who were simply shooting back after the BATF had actually flown helicopters overhead and killed a number of the Davidians, simply shooting blindly through the roof and killed several of them. And, of course, I talked to Sarah Blaine, who headed the jury that heard the trial, and she told me, we didn't think the Davidians were guilty at all. We thought the wrong people were on trial. In other words, they thought that the government officials should have been on trial, but, of course, they couldn't do that. They sent the Davidians away. Many have been solitary confinement for 30 or 40 years of imprisonment, and the people who planned this whole thing, David Koresh had offered to let them come in at any time they wanted to and look around, and of course, the ATF refused to do that. They weren't interested in that. They called it showbiz. That was the name of the operation. It was showbiz, and boy, of course, all the little children and the women were killed. And, of course, if you get into the background of that, we have a DVD on this. They sent in special forces troops, actually, to kill them. They killed the people. The Davidians were all shot in the back of the head. Why were they shot in the back of the head? I talked to a woman who had been there when somebody watching the spectacle from a distance with a telescope. had reported to Clive, I've forgotten Clive's mother's father's last name, but it was his mother. He today heads the Davidians. And she told me that this man called and said, look, I was watching at the back of the compound. They marched them all out, they lined them up, and then they shot them all in the back of the head and dragged them back in again. And even one of them, of course, had his arm and leg torn off. That was never brought out. He was run over by a tank, and they dragged him back into the ruins. And the American people have never been told the truth about what happened at Waco and who it was who killed those little children. Janet Reno and Bill Clinton were directly responsible, and they've never been taken before the bar of justice, but they will stand, at least, in my opinion, in the future life. And we do incidentally still have that DVD on what happened in Waco. We think every American should understand that they interview several people who talk to the Special Forces people who bragged about how they were sent in to kill the women and the children. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have to remember that the Waco program, if you will, the operational program that was followed by the ATF and the FBI, was something that grew out of a Republican administration, the first Bush administration, the administration of the first George Bush, was really deeply involved with the Texas government, with the ATF, and ultimately with the FBI in the planning of the raid that was carried out in February of 1993. It was sort of a domestic Bay of Pigs. It was something Bill Clinton inherited. But of course, Bill Clinton chose exactly the right attorney general to preside over this type of an operation, because he had developed, Janet Reno had developed a reputation, a well-earned reputation in Florida as somebody who was draconian in the prosecution of suspected child abusers, not necessarily because she had maternal feelings toward children. Of all the public figures I've been exposed to, I would find Janet Reno to be the least suspicious of harboring maternal impulses. But for whatever reason, perhaps feminist ideology, she simply believed that this was something that had to be pursued hammer and tongs by the government. She ruined the lives of many innocent people in Florida before becoming Attorney General, so when she was plugged into the administration and presented with a plan by Special Forces, I believe it was General Shoemaker, who presented her with the plan for Waco, she signed off on it very readily. And so you had people from Delta Force put together as a hostage rescue team, the same way that the FBI's hostage rescue team was put together in the late 1980s to go and rescue people who were in really bad terrorist-type hostage situations. The Delta Force was the first military unit that was put together for that purpose. You had Delta operators on the ground on the day of April 19, 1993, pulling triggers, according to people I interviewed who were in the Special Forces. And that something was brought out in the Waco A New Revelation documentary as well. But this is something that had been planned and then presented to Janet Reno, taking advantage of her psychology, I believe. But it all had its genesis in the first Bush administration, which also was responsible for the atrocity at Ruby Ridge, which was where you saw the family of Randy Weaver being set up and assaulted by that so-called hostage rescue team from the FBI. And Lon Horiuchi, the FBI sharpshooter, is now in protective custody, was involved in both Waco and Ruby Ridge. He's the one who blew the head off of Vicki Weaver while she was holding a nursing child. And really, the point I'm elaborating on here, and it's something that bears repeating, although it's obvious to most of our listeners, I would assume, is that the two major parties are entirely fungible. You're dealing with basically the same entity under different brand names, whether you're talking about Republicans or Democrats. Now you have Bush the Younger presiding over this sordid episode in Texas, although the federal government's not directly involved. The FBI did have access to the YFZ ranch and the FLDS temple after the Sheriff's Department, the Texas Rangers, were granted access, and after the Midland County Sheriff's Department SWAT team materialized with federally subsidized and federally provided military hardware, including an APC. The thing about this is that the federal government, whether it was directly involved in the planning and execution of this raid, subsidized the people who carried it out.
And let me just mention, APC is an armored personnel carrier.
Armored personnel,
so here they're going to go, and of course they're going to arrest all these women and children, and they've got the armored personnel carrier. They've got militarized police SWAT team, you know, with their helmets and their armor on, automatic weapons, you know. against a peaceful enclave there. But, of course, they wanted a spectacular thing. Nobody stands against the force of the government. We're here to help you, and that's why we're going to take your children and put them all into, put them into foster homes, because we want to protect these children. Take them away from their mothers. Whether you like polygamy or not has nothing to do with that. Why do you want to punish the children? Why do you want to put them into a child abuse system where these children are molested? Many of them are, some of them die. Many of them are molested, not only psychologically but sexually, and nothing is ever done to the foster parents who mistreat those children.
Well, according to Angie Voss, who's the chief CPS, that's Child Protective Services investigator for Texas, there are, and I'm quoting from her testimony under oath, specific men in the community, the FLDS community, who are suspected perpetrators of child abuse. If there are specific suspects, go after the specific suspects. But they don't have the specific suspects, at least people that they've been willing to identify. They don't have specific suspected victims, and the one purported victim whose telephone call triggered this entire thing was living in Colorado City, that's an FLDS enclave in Arizona. She was living in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and she's a veteran hoaxer. She's a 33-year-old Democratic Party activist and delegate pledged to Barack Obama next month's Democratic convention in Colorado. And she was the person who called the hotline and professed to be a 16-year-old polygamous wife who'd given birth before she turned 16, who had been impregnated by a 50-year-old man who was very physically abusive to her. Of course, this was made up out of whole cloth. And it was largely reconstructed. I think this is very interesting. This call from this Rosita Swinton character in Colorado Springs was largely reconstructed on the basis of material that had been publicized in an Oprah Winfrey program last fall. She had listened to this program and taken notes, apparently, and developed an interest in the FLDS movement, which I consider to be a cult. And she had apparently put together this remarkably detailed story where she was supposedly this woman who was impregnated at a very young age in violation of a law that was passed by the Texas state legislature specifically to target the FLDS. And she used names and identified people who had been in the news, including this fellow Jessup, who had been convicted of child sexual misconduct in Arizona. He's in Arizona. He's never been able to go to Texas until recently. He traveled to Texas, was interviewed by the Texas Rangers, I understand, by the side of the road, and then released without ever being taken into custody. But he couldn't simply go to Texas. He could not be in El Dorado because he's a registered sex offender, and his whereabouts were known. He was in Arizona at all times, material to the allegations by this 33-year-old woman from Colorado Springs. But she said that her name was Sarah, and she was a polygamous wife of this Jessup character. And on the basis of this anonymous complaint, an affidavit was sworn out by a female Texas Ranger who took a version of the complaint taken down by another woman named Jessup, who was a former member of the FLDS Church and who has become the head of an underground railroad to take people out of that community, people who want to leave, who have a difficult time, look to her. And she gets them out, provides them with clothing and money and a stake in a new life. She was the one who transcribed the comments made by this anonymous caller. So you have basically third-party hearsay that goes into an affidavit that was used as a pretext to get the sheriff and the Texas Rangers into the property. And while they're doing that, you had the SWAT team from Midland County, Texas, mobilized and en route. They had to be en route already. And it's an important point to recognize that they didn't show up at the YFC ranch because of resistance from the FLDS members. There was no resistance. The local sheriff there in Schleicher County, Texas, contacted the bishop of the community and urged him to tell his people to cooperate. So they all cooperated with the investigation. And so you have these people mobilized for the sole and express purpose of kidnapping the children at gunpoint. You actually had a military invasion of an insular American religious community where you had armor in the form of an APC, you had these people with automatic weapons, you had spotters and snipers ringing the compound.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, William, go right ahead.
You had, the point of it, you had this fully realized military assault on a non-resisting, peaceful religious community in the United States of America for the purpose of taking these children into custody. And this was all done on the basis of an affidavit that did not identify a specific accuser or a specific victim. And last Thursday, when Judge Barbara Walther convened the first hearings into what was going to be done with the children who are now in state custody, she committed a grave act of, I would consider it to be judicial malfeasance, by not making her first priority to issue an order to the state of Texas demanding that they produce the victim, produce a witness, an accuser, a specific person to validate that affidavit so that the warrant on which the raid was conducted would be validated and vindicated. She didn't do that. What she should have done, what she must have done in order to make this in some sense legitimate from the perspective of due process, was to validate the terms of that warrant. She didn't do that. And I suspect it's because she knew that this so-called Sarah didn't exist. The Texas Rangers had been in contact with the woman who took that phone call. They had her monitor the phone call, record the phone calls from this so-called Sarah, the supposed 16-year-old victim of child abuse. They had identified the caller as somebody living in Colorado. They sent people from the Rangers to Colorado Springs. They tracked down this Rosita Swinton. This all happened roughly contemporaneous with the seizure of the children from the YFC ranch. And before the hearing that was convened last Thursday by Judge Barbara Walther, by the time the hearing was convened, Swinton had been exposed as the con artist behind that phone call. And she had been arrested in Colorado Springs by the local police on charges relevant to other instances in which she has gone on the telephone and falsely reported being a victim of child abuse. And there are elements of this case, elements of the arrest of Rosita Swinton, that are now sealed. They're under judicial seal, not at the request of authorities in Colorado, but at the request of authorities in Texas. That's something that just came out this afternoon in the wire services. That's something I'd long suspected, but I found out that they'd sealed the records. Well, what happened is that, as a matter of professional courtesy to the child snatchers in Texas, they're not going to allow the public to have access to the arrest report on Rosita Swinton that would make it pretty clear that the authorities in Texas knew before they grabbed the kids, they knew that the call was bogus.
But I think what the important issue here is the fact that certainly that polygamy is illegal both in Texas and certainly in states throughout the country. So if polygamy is wrong, then they should go after the polygamous husband, but they should not punish the wives and they should not punish the children. Because polygamy is taking place, you know, does not mean that you should take the children away from their parents, that you could take nursing children away from their mothers who are nursing them. I mean, this is the thing. They're punishing the wrong people.
Yeah. It is so monumentally, staggeringly perverse that you have over 500 people, the 437 children and over 100 mothers, who have been held involuntarily as prisoners now by the state of Texas for a number of weeks. None of them has ever been charged with a crime. They're described as victims of child abuse or suspected victims of child abuse. The way that Judge Walther described it, the way that Angie Voss, the chief investigator for the CPS in Texas, described it for the benefit of Judge Walther, was that...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is, of course, talking about the tragedy of this, what has happened in Texas as far as this a polygamous group is concerned, and certainly they admittedly were a cult. If there is a charge to be brought, it would be brought against the men who are carrying on polygamous relationships with the women. But why would you put the women in custody? Why would you take the children away from their mothers? Why would you put these children, innocent victims, into an abusive child abuse system? And, of course, people have investigated this and said it's terrible. Sometimes the children die in this abuse system. Sometimes the children are sexually molested. Psychologically, it's going to scar those children for the rest of their lives. Why do they want to punish the children? Why do they want to hurt the children? If you want to go after the polygamous men, fine, go after them and arrest them and put them in prison. Try them and put them in prison. But why would you, Chris, you take the children away from their mothers? Go ahead.
Well, once again, the chief investigator for the CPS said that they had evidence not of abuse, but of the potential for future abuse. So it was a preemptive strike. Just as we fight preemptive wars now, we prosecute people preemptively for crimes that may be committed sometime in the undetermined future. Now, that's not the way that justice operates in the Anglo-Saxon tradition. You have to have specific crimes that are illustrated by specific evidence as the basis of an indictment, and then a jury of our peers has to convict people beyond a reasonable doubt of committing or preparing to commit a crime, immediately preparing to commit a crime. You can convict somebody on a conspiracy count without the actual crime having been materially committed. If you can prove that the person was planning to commit the crime and in the process of committing the crime, you can convict that person of conspiracy to commit it. What you cannot do is say that at some indefinite date on the future, on the basis of what I take to be your beliefs and inclinations, you will most likely commit this crime against people yet to be specified. And on that basis, I will preemptively convict you of the crime that somebody you may commit. That's like that Steven Spielberg, Philip K. Dick movie, Minority Report, where there's a department of pre-crime that acted on the basis of these oracular telepaths who could supposedly see into the future. I mean, that's basically what's going on in Texas right now, is that the CPS professes to have oracular insight into the future of the FLDS. And on the basis of the teachings of that group, they are now holding the children and separating the children from the mothers who believe in the tenets of that faith. And they're now farming the children out basically for the purpose of insinuating them into the public school system so as to deprogram them of beliefs and social values that are not considered to be compatible with the glorious state and culture we live under. Now, once again, neither you nor I bears a brief for the FLDS doctrines, its practices. Polygamy, of course, is something that has been criminalized in this country. I think it's rather silly to criminalize polygamy given the fact that the same government is abetting all kinds of other sexual deviance and promiscuity. But the point here is that there is not evidence that any of these people had anything to do with the crime. And if there had been crimes committed, you're dealing with victims. So the state has to make the case against the perpetrators. The state does not have the luxury of simply assuming that crimes have been committed or that crimes would someday be committed and then take away the freedom of the so-called victims of that crime. And the other thing that I find really dangerous here, Dr. Stan, is the other shoe I've expected to see drop, and it dropped this afternoon. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada, the Democrat from Nevada who controls the Senate, wrote a letter to the Attorney General of the United States today saying that what happened in El Dorado, Texas, and I'm quoting now from that letter, illustrates the depth of the problem and the pressing need for federal leadership to combat this problem. And he said that the federal government needs to work with state officials in several states to look at, quote, the broader pattern of serious criminal conduct by all those who use multiple marriages to abuse women and children. Federal assistance is vital. The recent raid of one polygamous compound in Texas uncovered many of the problems, but Texas may be the tip of the iceberg.
And, of course, I think what's really so interesting is the fact they're going to take DNA tests from all of the children and from all of the women and then from all of the men. And they're going to, of course, then those, of course, will be part of the DA data banks throughout all time. Of course, anybody who's arrested, they can take the DNA from them. But did they arrest the children? Did they arrest the mothers?
Well,
no,
they
were forcibly take the DNA from them, not voluntarily, but forcibly take them so they can, of course, track their parentage. I think it's a dangerous precedent, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, just last week, there was a very energetic and creative prosecutor in New York who got a court to agree with the proposition that a DNA sample is sufficient grounds for an indictment. In other words, you don't have to identify a suspect. You just have to identify the DNA sample and then use that as the basis for an indictment against whoever would match the DNA profile, the sample found at the scene of a crime. And, of course, the really interesting possibilities that sort of butt off from that precedent in New York include sort of a criminal version of what happens now in the realm of civil asset forfeiture.
All that stuff, we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is William Grigg, and go right ahead, William.
I was talking about the fact that a prosecutor in New York City recently got a court to agree with the idea that it's not necessary to identify a suspected perpetrator in order to file a criminal indictment. If you have a DNA sample, you can file an indictment against the DNA sample and then find a match for that DNA sample and prosecute that person without building any more of a case than that. Apparently, you can at least indict somebody on the basis of a DNA sample found at the scene of a crime. There are all kinds of reasons why people might leave a DNA sample at the scene of a crime that have nothing to do with committing that crime. But in the realm of civil asset forfeiture, which is the practice of seizing property, finding and convicting the property of involvement in the crime, you see all kinds of lawsuits that are filed that have titles like USA versus $150,000 in the United States currency. There was a case a couple of years ago where a fellow was stopped by a state trooper in one of the Dakotas, and during the course of inspecting the car, as the state trooper issued a traffic citation, he found something like $150,000 secreted in the floorboards or something of that sort. No evidence was ever produced that the driver had any connection to a criminal act, but the money was confiscated and forfeited as the suspected product of drug trafficking. They didn't have to make the case that this guy had committed a crime. They found the property guilty. That's called in rem, against the thing. That's a procedure that's very often used in asset forfeiture involving money as well as homes and automobiles and other assets. And the court decision that upheld this principle, the idea that carrying large amounts of cash itself is evidence of criminal activity, that's a very close paraphrase of what that ruling held, was entitled The United States of America versus $150,000 in United States currency. Now, with the advent of DNA sampling and the idea that you can prosecute, or at least you can indict a DNA sample, you're going to find criminal cases having names such as State of New York versus DNA sample, and then you list the genetic sequence of that DNA sample. That's going to come. And now that the government of the United States claims the proprietary control over our very genetic material and is building this huge database of genetic samples, what they will be able to do is go through the database of genetic samples, find a match, and then on the basis of a genetic sample, the sample of genetic material found at the crime scene, you can find yourself being prosecuted for something you had nothing to do with. And if your genetic sample is close enough, say that you had a relative who happened by that crime scene and deposited DNA somehow.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg. And before we go on, William, I would like you to go ahead and tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site and what they'll find there.
I appreciate that. My blog is entitled Pro Libertate. I chose that phrase. It's a Latin phrase that means for freedom, because that's the focus of my blog. It's monomaniacally focused on the issue of human liberty and the threats to it. And the threats are all-encompassing and always proliferating. I try to update it between 3 and 5 times a week. And usually what I do is I write a fully realized opinion column between 1,200, 1,500, 2,000 words that is illustrated with hyperlinks, photographs, and often with videos. Rather than simply writing brief snippets or brief takes on passing matters or little ephemeral reflections on the affairs of the day, I will usually write a new essay, a fresh essay, between 3 and 5 times a week. This past week, I've been focusing very heavily on what's gone on with the El Dorado case, and the essays that I've written have been consistently updated several times a day because this is a very fast-moving story. Generally speaking, however, you'll see a new essay from me between 3 and 5 times a week, as my schedule permits. To find Pro Libertate, the easiest way to do it, you can Google Pro Libertate, just write the phrase into the Google search engine, and my blog will be one of the first returns, if not at the top of that list. But you can go to the web page, the home page of the Welch Foundation, for which I work as the editor-at-large. And the web address for that home page is called The Right Source. The web address is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. You go to the homepage there, and scroll down about a third of the way down the page. Look at the left-hand side of the screen. You'll find my photograph, a dark-complexioned fellow with a Van Dyke beard, and you can find a hyperlink that will take you to my daily blog. And at the top of the page of the right source, there's a banner ad from my most recent book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can order that directly through the Right Source website. It's also available through RadioLiberty.com, and you can also buy it by way of Amazon.com. And for those who are in California, I think it's worthwhile to point out that I'll be speaking this Saturday at the Spring Convention of the United Republicans of California at the Embassy Suites Hotel in Arcadia. The second day, the first day, of course, the evening session is for members of the United Republicans of California, as they will be thrashing out procedural matters. But the second day, in the morning and afternoon, there will be a number of speakers who will be talking about a number of subjects having to do with the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the unfolding police state, the assault on property rights, the budding North American Union, a number of subjects. And I'm the lead-off speaker. I start at 9 o'clock that morning. I'll be talking about my new book and about the unfolding police state. So once again, that's the Spring Convention of the United Republicans of California in Arcadia, California, at the Embassy Suites Hotel.
And I would encourage you, if you're interested in getting my, of course, you can contact your rock, and if you don't know how to contact them, you can contact us, and we'll put you in touch with them. But I'm sure it'll be an excellent, excellent talk. So basically, of course, William was talking about this idea of indicting DNA. Right now, there's a prosecutor who wants a judge to indict a DNA specimen, and of course, once that DNA specimen is indicted, then of course, all they have to do is find out who has something similar to that.
Yeah.
Of course, you have to understand that certainly, if you have a relative, they'll have a very, very similar DNA, and of course, you could certainly well be indicted. DNA is not always perfect. In other words, as because of a relative can have very similar DNA, why you could be indicted for a crime that a relative or somebody else had committed. DNA, certainly you have to have more than DNA to prove a crime.
Well, the thing is, if you're indicted, particularly by a federal attorney, chances are you'll be put in a position where you're going to have to accept a plea bargain of some kind. That's the new game. There are all kinds of efforts underway to circumnavigate the trial by jury guarantee of the Constitution. Most of the prosecutions that are waged by federal prosecutors, and an increasingly dominant percentage of the prosecutions that are staged by state and county prosecutors, end with plea bargains rather than with a jury verdict. So if you find yourself indicted on the basis of DNA evidence, chances are they're going to try to find some way to browbeat you or extort from you a plea bargain agreement, whether it involves pleading to some kind of a procedural offense or whether it involves a plea bargain that deals with a completely irrelevant offense. Chances are once they've identified you as a plaintiff, they're not, or as a defendant, they're not going to let you go without picking out a pound of your flesh. And the thing about DNA sample is that if you have a hair follicle or a hair sample that is left at a site, that will provide sufficient DNA for investigators. And so the nightmare scenario is that you have a brother, you know, a sibling, or a child who happens to be present somewhere where a crime of violence later takes place. For instance, it could be a convenience store, and somehow he leaves a genetic sample at a counter where later a murder is committed. That genetic material is taken, and on the basis of the fact that the database shows a near match to you, you're identified as the suspect, you're indicted for the crime, and next thing you know, you're caught in the horrors of what is our post-constitutional so-called justice system. But what triggered this discussion, of course, is what's going on with these FLDS children, where they're being forcibly sampled. They're being compelled to give DNA samples, both the children and the mothers, and there's no real purpose to this because they don't have the matching DNA from the suspected parents, the fathers of these children. And if the purpose is to match paternity, they already have the documentation. They already have the certified birth certificates of these people. Granted, there's every reason to think that there might be fraud going on in terms of issuing birth certificates because these are children who are illegitimate in the eyes of the law if they're the offspring of polygamous unions. But you can establish who the maternal parent is, and then you can find some way of backtracking if you're convinced that you're dealing with a specific case of a woman who gave birth when she was impregnated at an illegally young age. There are ways that you can find out by pressuring the mother who the suspected father is. And they're not doing any of this. They're simply sampling the kids and then sending them off to this horrible foster care system. And Dr. Stan, you adverted a few minutes ago to the fact that this foster care system in Texas is an engine of depravity and despair. This is something that Bruce Perry, the expert witness, the psychologist for the state of Texas, admitted under oath last week, that the foster care system in Texas would be very damaging and destructive to the FLDS children because their values are completely different. These are children who are homeschooled. They're very well-behaved. They're very disciplined. They prefer directed play to the type of activities that most American children like. They don't involve themselves in competitive sports. They're involved in collaborative rather than competitive sports because they live in a very communalistic system. They're people who have a diet and lifestyle that is very different from the consumerist society in which we live. They haven't been exposed to television. In other words, they don't have anything in common with most of the potential foster care families that would receive them. So that's one element of the destructive nature of the foster care system, but there's an even darker one, and it's something I wrote about last week. There was an investigation that began in 2004 by the Comptroller's Office of the state of Texas. There was an auditor by the name of Carolyn Strayhorn who started to investigate the deaths and mistreatment of children in the Texas foster care system. She discovered and documented that in 2004 there were 38 foster children who were killed. 48 were killed in 2005. She pointed out that about 100 children received treatment during that time for poisoning from medication. 63 foster children received medical treatment for rape that occurred while in the foster care system. And 142 children gave birth while in the state foster care system. Now, of the child rape victims, the largest cohort were between the ages of 12 and 15. And quite frequently, you're dealing with child rape that results from sexual assault by people from the foster family, whether you're talking about siblings who are part of the foster family or the male parent in that foster family or the step-parent. That's another alignment, another configuration we see quite a bit. Of the child rape victims, something like 13% of them were aged 3 years old and younger. You're talking about toddlers being raped and molested in the foster care system. This has all been proven. These are not greasy insinuations or vague allegations of the sort that are now taken as fact with respect to the practices and the behavior of the FLDS. These are documented cases and documented percentages and documented problems and traumas and atrocities and crimes that are being committed in the foster care system into which these children are going to be placed after being torn at gunpoint from their mothers.
Well, I think it's a great miscarriage of justice, but what really bothers me most, William, is there is no outcry from the people across America.
Oh, I know. Well, you know, Michael Reagan, a talk show host for whom I don't have an abundance of respect, made a good point in a column he wrote for townhall.com a few days ago. He said that there really should be a concerted effort on the part of the evangelical Christian church to take care of these children, to protect them, to provide them with suitable environments and homes and loving care and support, both the children and the mothers here, that it's really the responsibility of the church to intervene here on behalf of the victims, whether they're victims of abuse within that cult or whether they're whether you understand them to be victims of the cult that we call the government. I mean, they're documentably victims of the second sort. Some of them might be victims of the first sort, but in either case, Michael Reagan pointed out, the silence of the Christian church here is both deafening and shameful, and it really should be the job of the Christian church to intervene here and to help. And the other thing that really galls me, and this is something perhaps that would be seen as rather controversial even for this program, Dr. Stan, is the silence of the mainstream Mormon church leadership in Salt Lake City. They have been doing everything they possibly can to convince the public that they have nothing at all to do with the FLDS. They don't in the sense of organizational connection. They have no organizational connection to the FLDS or any of the other splinter groups that have hived off of the main Mormon movement. But these are people who have the same religious heritage. They share most of the same doctrines, although the practices differ. They are part of the same culture. They speak the same argot. They sing the same hymns. They have the same cultural preferences. They share the same history of persecution at the hands of governments, both state and federal, in the 19th century. Their histories diverge in about 1920. But up until that point, they have the same ancestry and the same heritage of persecution. Horrible things were done to the Mormons by the federal government and by the state governments in the 19th century. There were horrible things that were done by some Mormons, but often you have a situation where people catch the grief that has been sown by their leaders. And that's a really good description for what happened to the Mormons in the 19th century. There was actually a document signed in the state of Missouri by the governor at the time. His name was Lilburn Boggs, that was called an extermination order. The word extermination should never be used by any official of this government in any capacity. We should never be talking about exterminating an entire group of human beings. But that was the order that was signed in 1838 by Lilburn Boggs, the governor of Missouri. It, I think, is the only example we can find, apart from the appalling treatment of the Plains Indians by the federal government in the latter half of the 19th century, the only example we can find where there was a conscious and overt policy to exterminate any group of people by any government in the United States, and that was done to the Mormons. And it just strikes me as galling. You know, I was raised as a Mormon. It strikes me as galling that the mainstream Mormon church in Salt Lake City is so concerned about its PR profile that they're not doing anything they can to palliate the trials and the anguish of these mothers and these children as they're forced apart by the guns of the state. I mean, that's the sort of a thing that would rend the heart of any decent human being, I think. But somebody who was brought up understanding the history of persecution that the Mormons suffered, I think, would have to understand that what's going on in Texas is wrong. Whatever you think of the doctrines and practice of that community, however appalled and repulsed you are by the spectacle of middle-aged men, quote-unquote, marrying young girls and some of the other misconduct that's been going on in the FLDS community. You know, when mothers and children, you know, nursing mothers are torn away from their children on the orders of the state, I mean, that's the sort of a thing that simply cannot be justified.
I agree with you totally, and I really feel it's a real tragedy that neither the Christian church nor the Mormon church has come to the defense. In fact, nobody's really coming to the defense except some of the, a few people like certainly Michael Reagan and yourself. People have to understand that if we are not incensed when these atrocities occur, why, who will be? And maybe we've been deconditioned by the murder, of course, of Randy Weaver's family. Mm-hmm. And nobody was ever held responsible by the murder of all those children, the 68 people there at Waco, and nobody was concerned. Nobody's really too concerned about what happened 2 years later at the Oklahoma City bombing and the fact that the government refuses to this day to release the pictures of, that were taken outside the Murrah building just before the explosion, because they say there's a continued examination. We're really looking into this still. That's why we can't release the films that show that there were other people involved besides Timothy McVeigh. And, of course, nobody seems to be too concerned about all the people who are dying over in Iraq today, all the civilians. Isn't it too bad? And then, of course, we spend more time really worrying who's going to win the NBA, the championship, or who's going to be drafted here this next week for the NFL. The American people seem to have lost their soul, and really, of course, there are going to be terrible, terrible consequences of that, because if God is just, he's going to bring justice on America.
Well, you make a really good point here about our self-destructive capacity for total absorption in ephemeral distractions. Somebody wrote a book, I think it might have been Neil Portman, Neil Postman, rather, about 20 years ago, called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And this is something that is done by design. The people who are in charge of molding the public mind understand that it is to their advantage to make sure that the public is fixated on things that are completely inconsequential. I do think it's interesting that when the Houston Rockets play the Utah Jazz in Salt Lake City in a couple of days on national television, there is going to be a protest of sorts that's organized to condemn the actions of the state government in Texas people are going to show up there at the Energy Solutions Arena in Salt Lake City with protest signs demanding that the FLDS children be let go and reunited with their mothers. I don't know how much coverage they're going to get on television. That's not the sort of a thing that really goes well with a diet of sports distraction, but chances are some of this is going to seep through, and I hope that it does have some impact. But the thing that I find interesting that I was told by an attorney in Texas who had me on a radio show yesterday to talk about this case is that the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, actually on one occasion phoned into a radio program to complain about the fact that somebody, a caller to that program, had criticized the state government of Texas for what it was doing. And, you know, that level of scrutiny of what is being said in the press right now is really quite unusual, particularly for a state.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
All
there.
Right.
You're talking about, of course, the governor of Texas
yes.
calling into a radio program and being critical because, of course,
yeah.
they were being critical of the state of Texas and what he had authorized.
Yeah. The thing is, we learned just last week, last Sunday, about the program that the Pentagon has for what they call, I believe it's the force multiplier, the message force multiplier, of having these paid spokesmen go onto the various network programs as supposedly independent military analysts and promoting the Pentagon lying. I don't doubt for a second that the Texas state government, for all I know, the federal government as well, have people who are spending their time monitoring what is said on radio programs or monitoring what is being said in the blogosphere or on television or printed in the newspapers about the seizure of the FLDS children, and when necessary, getting involved in trying to manipulate the public perception of the events. I've seen a number of posters on a number of blogs, seen the same names posting the same messages defending the Texas government. I don't doubt for a second that there are people who have been tasked to do that. But they really don't have to do a whole lot of cleanup work, damage control, because the public is completely torpid. I mean, for the first 4 or 5 years, actually the first couple of years after Waco, until the Murrah bombing of April 19, 1995, which was conducted with the active help of the federal government at the very least, the message was never again are we going to see an atrocity like Waco. This is Waco again. This is Waco revisited without the spectacular immolation of scores of innocent people. And it testifies of the resilient evil of the people who are ruling us and their unbounded appetite for coercion. And what we have to understand is it's the FLDS today. Next week it could be the Mennonites. The Mennonites dress the same way. They're insular. They homeschool their kids. They're separatists from this community, the collective that has been established for our benefit. And the week after that, it could be homeschoolers of another variety. It has to stop right now or it's going to metastasize.
I share your concern completely, and I think that what we need to understand is that they are monitoring everything that's said on radio, they're monitoring what's said on television, and if you get out of line, they're going to come after you. They really do. I have no question at all that they monitor everything that's said on our program and many other programs just exactly as such as ours, because the last thing they want is for the American people to rise up in the righteous indignation and say, you've taken our country away, you've taken away our freedom. Our guest has been William Grigg. Fascinating as always, William. We certainly look forward to talking to you next week. Have a wonderful time down there in Los Angeles at UROC.
Thanks so much, and God bless.
And you too. Bye-bye. And we'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly I hope you enjoy our conversations with William Grigg. He's certainly one of the most astute observers we have in our country. And, of course, he mentioned he was raised as a Mormon. He is now an evangelical Christian, although it came at a certain cost to him to actually break with the Mormon Church. But be that as it may, certainly we hope that many of you out there will be concerned about the move towards a police state. We have a great DVD. It's called The Planned Police State. And then we have a syllabus that goes with that, and we recommend very strongly the syllabus as you go with these talks. We have the talk on the forbidden secret with the syllabus. We have the talk on sustainable development with the syllabus. We have a talk on the Iraq, the untold story, and it's the story of all the wars of the last century, and And, of course, how they were all, every single one of them was contrived exactly as Iraq was contrived. The decision was made to go to war with Iraq long before, of course, the 9/11 attack. And certainly Secretary of the Treasury, Paul O'Neill, in his book, The Price of Loyalty, page 96, tells about attending NSC, National Security Council, meetings in January and February of 2001. That would be 7 or 8 months before the 9/11 attack. And there they were already planning on how they would get the American people to go along with a preemptive attack on Iraq. How they would get the American people to go along with a preemptive attack. And a million people have died because of that preemptive attack. And who is responsible? Oh, shucks, it was just a mistake. Well, you, of course, need to hear my talk, Iraq, the Untold Story. I might mention, you need also to get our pamphlets. We have a 3-pamphlet set, Foreknowledge 9/11, and then the True Story of 9/11. Foreknowledge of 9/11, and of course, that's 3 pamphlets, inexpensive, and then our True Story of 9/11, simply 1 pamphlet, but all the information you need to know about what happened on September 11th is contained there. Because, of course, they knew the attack was coming, and they did nothing to stop it. And certainly, you need to have some idea of what's gone on in the background, that they left those people there to die. All you need to do, of course, is look at the go up on the Internet and Google in Building 7 video, Building 7 video, and watch Building 7 come down. It wasn't hit by an airplane. It came down at 5:20 in the afternoon. The center of the building collapsed initially. That's what you do with a controlled demolition, and then the whole base of the building collapsed. That was a controlled demolition. How did Osama bin Laden get the explosives into that building to take it down? Or the other thing, of course, the crash site in Pennsylvania, Flight 93, there's no wreckage. There's just a big hole in the ground. Just a big hole in the ground, no wreckage. Have you ever seen a wreckage site with, of course, no plane wreckage there? If you want to, we can send you a copy of the picture of that, of the wreckage site. And, of course, there was no wreckage, just a hole in the ground. How could you crash a plane and just leave a hole in the ground and no wreckage? Ladies and gentlemen, we've been lied to. If they lied to us about one thing, they've lied to us about everything. On that morning of 9/11, there were something like 21 reported hijackings, and the FAA and NORAD were trying to track on 21 or more reported hijackings. And, of course, on some of these, they were feigning crashing them into buildings. In fact, Flight 11, American Flight 11, after it had crashed into the North Tower, why, of course, the transponder was turned on in the plane, and it continued broadcasting. It was just flying towards Washington, D.C. This is all covered in our... You need to get the source material. You need to find out what the truth is. Of course, how would you, after you'd crashed a plane into the North Tower, how could the transponder come on and the plane be flying and being tracked moving towards Washington, D.C.? Nothing as it appears to be. It's all there in the pamphlets. You need, of course, to get our talk on the hidden agenda. And, of course, along with that, of course, my syllabus to understand they're poisoning our children. You need to get the information on autism. They're poisoning our children. You need to get the information on aspartame and MSG. They're poisoning our children. They know what they're doing. Our number 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV, WAR.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.